across the UK, across continental North America, and around the world on the internet by webcast and by podcast. My name is Howard Hughes, and this is The Unexplained. Nice to have you there, wherever there might be. I know that I'm getting emails at the moment from every corner of the world, and really nice to hear from you. If you want to get in touch with me, go to the website, theunexplained.tv, follow the link, and you can send me an email from there. And don't forget, coming soon, details of The Unexplained Live 2, the cruise that I'm doing this year with Morella. Very exciting details. They're coming up very, very soon. And there will be another special micro website that will have booking details and the special code that you can use as a listener of The Unexplained. But all of that is still to come. Those details I expect within 10 days to 2 weeks maximum. So there we are. Very, very... And I can tell you, because I know who's going to be on it and I know where we're going. Ho-ho! This is going to be a good one. Now, special edition of The Unexplained This, the interview from my television show with Philip Mantle and Irina McCammon-Scott, which includes some never-aired-before material, and I'm talking video and sound recordings. Of course, you will hear the sound only on the podcast, but this is material that hasn't been released before now. I got it first from Philip, the hypnosis session of Calvin Parker, one of the two abductees at Pascagoula, the other one being Charlie Hickson, a recording of Charlie Hickson, a recording of the sheriff, who spoke with both of them and found their story, as you will hear, very compelling. That material is here, so we'll talk about that. Plus, I speak with a woman who may well have been an abductee on that night or around that night herself, along with her husband. I'm talking about Maria Blair and her husband, the late Jerry Blair. Their story only came to light 5 years ago. And she doesn't do interviews. She has done one with me. Now, there's a tiny clip of it in the television piece that I'm going to let you hear now. And at the very end of this, I'm going to let you hear all 28 or 29 minutes of the conversation with Maria Blair for you to make your own mind up about. So I'm very excited about this edition. It's extended. And of course, we've talked about the Pascagoula case before. We haven't had this new material. Remember, new material is coming out all the time. And we certainly haven't had Maria Blair's story to this extent before. And we've never spoken with her. And I have a feeling that very few people have. So you'll hear that on this unique edition of The Unexplained. Thank you very much for supporting me. Thank you to Adam for his work on the website and also getting the shows out to you. I'm going to take a very short break from the podcast, so I might miss 1 week soon. And just to remind you that the television show is not visual on the 20th of August. It will be a radio show. So there will be an Unexplained available on radio on the night of the 20th of August, but there won't be a visual television show because I think they're doing studio engineering maintenance on that night. So there will only be a radio show on the 20th. I think that's all I've got to say. If you want to contact me, go to the website, theunexplained.tv, and you can follow the link and send me an email from there. Tell me who you are, where you are, and how you use the show, if you could. And my Facebook page. Please regularly consult that for information about the show. It's the official Facebook page of The Unexplained with Howard Hughes. Okay, from my TV show first off, we're talking about the 50th anniversary, October the 11th it will be, of the Pascagoula alien abduction case and the new book from Philip Mantle and Irina McCammon-Scott, which is called Pascagoula Beyond Reasonable Doubt. This is a new conversation featuring new material, so we'll hear that. And then at the back of it, which wasn't aired on television, my full interview with Maria Blair. First of all, here's Philip Mantle. And I think it's about a decade or so since I first spoke to the one living person who was one of the two principals in this case, Calvin Parker, who along with Charlie Hickson essentially said that they were abducted on that night and taken up into a ship and they were tended to, experimented upon, by aliens. The Washington Post wrote it this way. What is certain about the night of October the 11th, 1973, is this. When Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker Jr. arrived at the sheriff's department in Pascagoula, Mississippi, they were frantic. They told authorities they'd just been abducted by aliens. Each had a puncture wound in one arm. Police tried to catch them in a lie, but it didn't work. Both men later passed polygraph tests. In June 2019, the riverbank where the men said the close encounter happened got an historical marker, calling it one of the best documented cases of alien abduction ever. After decades of avoiding media attention, Parker was there for the dedication that day. Charlie Hickson, of course, died in 2011. An extraordinary story, made even more so by new witnesses and new evidence that is still coming out to this day, as you will hear in this hour tonight, along with some exclusive video and audio never before broadcast. Now, it's all based on Philip Mantle and Irina McCammon-Scott's book, It's Here, Beyond Reasonable Doubt. This book is now available, and I commend it to you. If I flip through the pages there, you can see how much information is there. It is full of testimony, photographs, police records, newspaper stories, everything in there. It is a one-stop shop. I think it is the definitive work on this particular incident. And I thank you to Philip Mantle for sending me a copy of that book. Now, a little later this hour, we'll hear from Irina. Philip is on first. Philip, thanks very much for coming on.
Well, my pleasure, Howard. Nice to speak to you again.
We've got some stuff to give our audience tonight, haven't we, Philip?
Yeah, it's a question of, when we were discussing this, exactly what to choose, because there is so much, Howard, you know. And obviously we're going to get a little bit of a taster of that this evening.
What is the fascination, do you think, of this story? Because it's captivated and gripped you for years, hasn't it?
Yeah, I first read about it back in the 1980s in a magazine. And it was so different and so bizarre. As you've just mentioned, within hours of the incident happening, both gentlemen were in the sheriff's department being interrogated and then recorded secretly. That was Sheriff Fred Diamond and his deputy Glenn Ryder, and both have been, interviewed down the years. Sadly, they're no longer with us. But Glenn Ryder, for example, the deputy, didn't believe a word of it until he heard what's known as a secret tape. Basically, Charlie and Calvin were put in a room by themselves. They were left alone. What they didn't know, in the desk next to them, was a tape recorder playing, taping the conversation. The deputy came back a few minutes later, took it and thought, we'll get them now, lads, But absolutely not. I mean, Calvin, when you listen to it or you read the transcript, it was literally crawling up the walls. And it was then that their attitude, the law enforcement attitude, changed when they listened to this tape. And, of course, the very next day, they were sent to Singing River Hospital for an exam. That everything was okay. But on that night, in October the 11th, the first phone call they made was to Keesler Air Force Base, which is nearby, who basically gave them the brush off. However, the following morning, they were sent to Keesler Air Force Base to be checked for radiation. And the military people there said, well, while you're here, why don't you tell us what happened? And we have a full copy, a full transcript of the meeting that day. They didn't have a tape recorder there. They had a stenographer. So we have it, and we have all the names of who was there, the lot. And, this is the very next day. So these things are unique, Howard. If you think about Betty and Barney Hill, their experience wasn't relived until several years later, when they met Dr. Benjamin Simon, who put them under regressive hypnosis. Here you have Charlie and Calvin, in the sheriff's office within a couple of hours of this happening, telling them what they'd experienced. And, they said, especially Glenn Ryder, said on several TV interviews that, especially Calvin was scared half to death.
This is the thing. Not only were they... did they have physical signs, but they also were traumatized. They were traumatized in a way that it would be very difficult for somebody who was making it up to fake.
Absolutely. And Calvin was traumatized all his life. He's still traumatized to this very day. It wasn't until 2018 when he wrote his own book, which I published, that he finally told his wife and family the full story. It was just one of those things they knew not to ask him about. And it was, don't mention it. you know, especially with kids. Oh, don't mention that to Dad.
And in fact, Calvin moved around a lot, didn't he, to try and avoid the glare of publicity?
I mean, this may seem strange in today's society, but Calvin had recently become engaged to his childhood sweetheart, Waynette. He didn't want this story getting out because he thought her father wouldn't let him marry her, you know? And he was worried about that. And they did. They got married in November. What not a lot of people know is that shortly after, Calvin joined the United States Marine Corps. Not because he particularly wanted to be a Marine, but he thought in the Marines he would escape because they were being hounded by journalists, newspapers. You know, Charlie Hickson was fine dealing with the newspapers and the media. He accepted it, but not Calvin. He wanted nothing to do with it. There was a number of times he asked Charlie just to stop it. Don't keep this up. I want to forget about it. And if you remember the TV series of the Hulk in the 1980s, you know, Dr. Bruce Banner or Dr. David Banner, there was a journalist hunting him. And he was the Hulk, of course. And every time the journalist caught up, he would move to the next town. Well, Calvin was the real life. That's exactly what he did. His wife and 1.2 young children. And there was one place he went to work, Howard. He even used a false name. And the boss called him into the office one day and said, your name doesn't match your social security number. You're fired, you know? And it wasn't till 2018 he went to a funeral of a friend. And as he's coming out of the church, they're writing a book of condolence, and he wrote Calvin Parker.
Oh.
And then behind him, people seeing the name was the winks and the nudges. So his wife, Waynette, said, look, you know, enough's enough. Why don't you write a book? And he said, yes, darling, you know, just to placate her, really, if we're honest, Howard. And then out of the blue, he got a phone call from me. I had got the permission to republish Charlie Hickson's book that he wrote with William Mendes in 93. And I was looking to see if I could get an interview with Calvin, that's all, bring things up to date. And we chatted, and he was very polite, but he didn't tell me an awful lot, you know. I wasn't getting anywhere with him, Howard. But on the second phone call, he just said, oh, well, you know, I'm thinking of writing a book. And I said, well, you know, I can help you with that. So he had me on one side here, and he had his wife, Waynette, got him in a headlock across there in Pascagoula. So he decided to do it, and there were conditions attached. I wasn't allowed to edit it. I wasn't allowed to change anything. He had last say on everything we did. And you know, and he, in the end, he wished he'd done it, you know, earlier. You could almost feel the relief of getting the story out there. Because Calvin now is sadly very ill, otherwise we'd have him on here tonight.
Indeed, and it's very sad because that was part of the plan, wasn't it? We were going to get Calvin on, and he's very seriously ill at the moment. So my good wishes and thoughts go out to him. But I have interviewed him a couple of times, and what I always say when I've done those interviews is that I can see no reason why this man would fabricate this story. If you speak to him this year, the story is the same as it was 3 years ago. It doesn't change. Now, people who are making stuff up, their story changes. Overlay that with the fact that his demeanour is that of a very sincere man telling a true story that he wants to unburden himself of. And for those three reasons, I believe him. You know, I do, and I don't care what people think. That's my view of it. This is the 50th anniversary.
Calvin's view on it is, if you don't believe me, I don't care.
Now, you know, we can dispute what it was that he got involved in, how that happened, but the fact that he went through something, I think some people may disagree with me, but I think is beyond dispute. Now, tonight, the reason we're doing this tonight, not only is it the book, the 50th anniversary, but we've got some information that you've kindly provided and some audio and video clips here that have not been heard before, as far as I'm aware. So let's start After the two men are interviewed by the cops and secretly recorded, and surprise, surprise, they're sticking to their story when they're put in a private room. The microphone is recording them. They don't know it. They don't say, I think we're getting away with this one. They talk about their trauma and what happened to them both. Yeah. This is Sheriff Diamond, and I think it's important that we hear him. The audio quality is not fantastic, but it's perfectly understandable. This is him speaking, I think, is it the day after?
The day after. Right. Well, the interviewer came looking for Charlie and Calvin, and of course they were at the hospital being examined. And like news reporters, they needed a story, so the next best option was the sheriff. And this was the morning after.
Here he is.
This same object that was supposed to have picked these two men up was spotted about 45 minutes earlier up near the Van Cleve area. It was also spotted by two or three people in Pascagoula.
In other words, Sheriff Diamond, you've had, I know we talked to Deputy Glenn Ryder earlier this morning, there have been quite a few reports of this UFO in our area, and approximately at the same time that these two men have stated that they were taken aboard.
That's very true. They even give us a description of the character creatures or characters, which we might want to call them. It was aboard the craft. They give a good description of them. They seemed to be around 5 foot tall. They were real wrinkled and had sharp ears, sharp nose, and their mouth was very near the end of the nose. They were horrible creatures from the description we got from them.
Sheriff Diamond there. And I'm so pleased we've been able to hear that radio station interview, or that little clip of it, because he sounds like he's completely on side with it, that he, not that Absolutely. He believes them, but he thinks it's a credible story, yeah?
No, he did believe them. I mean, he didn't when they first turned up. I mean, we can understand the scepticism, but after speaking to them and seeing the state of them, he believes them. And one of the criticisms that I constantly get is, oh, no one else saw anything at the time. Well, you've just heard the sheriff there saying, we got more reports here in Van Cleve and other places. And what is interesting, you have to remember, after the abduction, Charlie and Calvin were driving home. And Charlie had a change of heart. They weren't going to tell anybody. So he pulled in a payphone, phoned Keesler, they give him the brush off. So they phoned the police department, and the police dispatcher who took the call is actually the son of Fred Diamond. Now, the sheriff is long since gone, but the dispatcher is still alive, and we've communicated with him, and he said, I took at least 50 calls of UFO sightings that night, Philip, at least 50 plus. And he said, I wrote them all down in the log. They were all handed in at the end of my shift. He says, and when I went back to the police station, there were people there in person reporting it as well. And what's interesting, Howard, he said there was even a clergyman there. Now, we found out, from newspaper archives that there was indeed a clergyman involved. He was called Pastor Emmanuel Sigalis. And he was a friend of a chap called Raymond Broadhurst, who worked for the Police and Probation Service. And on that night of 11th of October, Pastor Sigalis, Mr. Broadhurst, and a church volunteer, this was a church meeting they were going to, called Joanne Hallmark, she was sat in the back of the car. It was a kind of a meeting, for people with drinking problems. And as they're driving out of the town, guess what, flew straight across them, in front of them, on the highway, heading in the general direction of where Parker and Hickson was. And my colleague, Stephanos Panagiotakis, in Greece in 1981, interviewed Mr. Sigalis. And it was like I said, we got newspaper cuttings about it from the time. But the lady in the back of the car had disappeared. She wasn't in Pascagoula for a long time. She wasn't a native of the area. And she called Joanne Hallmark. Anyway, we tracked her down about a year or so later to Maryland. And we told her what we were looking for. And she remembered it all and gave us an interview. So we had the information from these sightings from 1973, an interview with the pastor in 1981, and then Joanne Hallmark a couple of years ago.
And there are other elements to this story too, which we'll get to later this hour, including a woman called Maria Blair, who I did a telephone interview with at home on Friday. This was a very new witness. Her and her husband, Jerry, were very much part of this. So this is a gift, this story that keeps on giving. People are appearing, people are remembering, people are telling you. Now, another element in this, which is very important and one of the main reasons we're doing this again now, is the hypnotic regression that you did on Calvin Parker. And for the first time on television, in the next segment of this show after we've taken commercials, you will see clips from that hypnotic regression. You will be able to decide for yourself. So, we're talking with Philip Mantle. Later this hour, we'll talk with his co-author, Irina McCammon-Scott. We're talking about the 50th anniversary of Pascagoula. The reason we're doing this is because there is a whole ton, a stash of information that Philip Mantle, the author of this new book, which is Beyond Reasonable Doubt, has sent to me and allowed me to use here tonight. Philip Mantle and Irina McCammon-Scott. The foreword is by Calvin Parker himself. It's all in there, but some of the video and audio material that this is based on, you will be seeing and hearing tonight, including video from the hypnotic regression of Calvin Parker. Now, this has been talked about. We've read about it. I've read transcripts of it, but I've never actually seen it. And, Philip, you organised this, didn't you?
Yes, I mean, Calvin's been under hypnosis, you know, a couple of times, and we have some tape recordings of it or some audio. And a few photographs of him, you know, during the process. But again, one of the things I talked about with Calvin was he wanted to leave a legacy. Like I said, he's, God bless him, his days are numbered, but he wanted to leave a legacy. And we had the opportunity to employ a local professional hypnotherapist, and she put him under hypnosis, and for me, one of the highlights of it was seeing the look on her face, Howard, because she didn't know what was about to come. You know, I did, and there were no questions prepared in advance. Whether Calvin's, you know, sat there in front of a microphone or he's under hypnosis, you only need to ask him a question and away he goes, you know. So we know, and I hired a professional cameraman to film it as well. So we have it on two cameras. We have the complete audio of it and visual. And it is preserved now for posterity. I know it's a contentious subject, using regressive hypnosis. I'm fully aware of that. But like all the data that we've put in the book, all we've said is make up your own mind about it. We're not trying to tell you anything. It's all there. You choose.
You sent me an awful lot of material. We've boiled it down tonight, and this is by no means all of it, into four clips. So let's work our way through these clips. This is Calvin Parker under hypnotic regression. This is recent, and this is exactly as it happened. Let's see the first of the clips.
I'm looking at the walls, and the lights coming out of the walls are softer light now. Mm-hmm. It's blue. And I don't see no bulbs, no fixtures. And we made a left turn and went about 15 foot down the hall, which was a wide hall. It was probably 8 foot hallway wide, and we come to a door. And I remember stopping at the door. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time that I got a view of what had a hold of me. And I couldn't see nothing but the skin, the face features, kind of grayish looking color.
Okay, very good. Describe as much as you can about what it looks like.
This thing was gray-looking color. Mm-hmm. He didn't have no neck. Mm-hmm. And I can't make out no face on it at the moment.
Interesting to hear him recount that, isn't it? This is what happened to him, he says, on board the craft. And the predominant color being blue, that's interesting because people who sighted whatever this thing was over Pascagoula all of them say this was blue. So that's pretty significant. No sense of the terror, though, the trauma that you know was reflected in his encounters with police.
No, I think in one of the earlier tapes that we did, Calvin was put under hypnosis by the late Bud Hopkins in 1993. And on that tape, you hear Calvin scream. And I know because I sat and listened to it and transcribed it. And it came as quite a shock. But different hypnotherapists use different techniques, Howard, to try and take that fear, not the emotion away from it, but the fear. So, you know, what we're having in the, as they do the induction going down before they're actually under hypnosis, they're making them aware that there's nothing to be frightened of, et cetera, et cetera. And there's different techniques to do that, I'm led to believe. So you don't always hear the fear, but there's a reason for it. You want to know clearly what they're seeing. But like I say, on the tape with Bud Hopkins, he lets out a scream, I can assure you. And it's not a pleasant thing to hear. Mm. The only time I ever heard that similar, Howard, was I was in A&E in Leeds in the hospital. I was in a cubicle there. And sadly, a young man had had a road traffic accident and had passed away. And his mum was sat by his bed. And she screamed.
Oh. So that's real life trauma. Yeah. And, you know, this is a very sober and very measured account. But it's a very clear narrative. Let's see now the second of these clips. We've got four. Here's number two.
Well, I don't know that it's a her. She don't have on a... She don't have no breast. Mm-hmm. And she has longer arms than most humans. Mm-hmm. And I noticed her fingers on each hand.
Okay.
But she does have on clothes. She has very little hair, but she does have hair. Mm-hmm. And it's, again, the room is blue and orange. Mm-hmm. So it makes her hair look kind of purplish looking. Okay. She has a mouth, mm-hmm, and eyes and ears and nose like the other one didn't have. She looks normal.
So this was one of a couple of kinds, a few kinds of creatures or aliens that he encountered. And this particular creature that was involved, I think, in the actual experiments or whatever they were doing on him was humanoid in character.
Was female, you know, and the only slight difference was the middle finger was somewhat longer and come to a point, and she put that in his mouth and up into his navel cavity, and it hurts. Calvin was non-best pleased about that. And the other creatures, as you hear him describe him, with, you know, bulky creatures, long arms, pincers. Calvin just nicknames them the big uglies. You know, that's just typical Southern humor, big ugly guy. And he was stood over in the corner, and he said he felt this presence at first, and he felt it was a female presence, and he couldn't understand that, you know. And she said to him, we call it telepathy, for want of a better word. We won't hurt you or anything like that. And but that wasn't exactly true. And at this point, I mean, Calvin's laying on this glass table. He cannot move. The only thing he can move is his eyes, you know, and he's trying to describe things in the best way he can. So there were two very distinctly different-looking creatures, beings, whatever you want to call them.
Okay. I want to get through these video clips because they are entrancing in many ways. So let's go to number three now. This is the third item.
And I do hear a noise.
Okay.
I hear a drip, drip, drip. Sound like I'm bleeding, or feels warm, like blood coming out from my hand. She's draining the blood out for some reason. And I think she's replacing it with something. I'm getting weak and weaker and weaker. and I get to the stage where I don't care if I live or die.
Keep going.
But I feel something coming in from my foot and blood going out my hand.
So Calvin there is saying under hypnosis that blood is being taken from him and it is being replaced by something else. Were there signs of this when he was examined in 1973 after the event?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things we have in the book is Charlie Hickson felt he had, when they first got over him, they pricked his arm. Calvin, during that session there, said that they removed his clothes, his lower clothes and his shoes and socks, and they stuck something in his foot and it hurt. Caught in a lot, I know it's short of time, but we found a document in the Center for UFO Studies archive that we call the puncture wounds document. It was done on the 13th of October, so 2 days after the event, and both gentlemen stripped to their underwear and someone gives them a quick once over and writes a report mentioning that there is these marks on Charlie's arm and on Calvin's foot. And it then says photographs were taken. Now, the photographs weren't in this file. However, they turned up a couple of years further down the line, and there you see, you know, these black and white photographs of marks on Charlie's arm, or marks on underneath Calvin's foot. And we know which picture is which because the names and the dates written on the reverse side of them. These are not digital photographs, they're the old-fashioned ones. And for me, Howard, when you have the witness testimony, and then you have this document called Puncture Wounds Document, which we believe was written by Dr. James Harder, and then followed on by the photographs, I think that put together, that's something, a compelling piece of evidence. On their own, they're not a lot, but when you put them together, I think they are very compelling. I mean, when the photographs came, was a gentleman by the name of Mark Rodiger at QFOS that sent them to me. He says, Philip, I've been going through some files. I found these today. I wasn't looking for them, but I assume you've got them anyway, but I thought I'd better send them. And when I opened my email, I was just sat there with my mouth open. You know, my wife thought I'd have another heart attack. You know, something had gone wrong. But I was stunned. I never thought we'd find them. And for me, it's, a fascinating piece of evidence.
And that's why your new book with Irina McCam and Scott, who we'll hear after the next set of commercials, I think, that's why your new book is so comprehensive. I said I wanted to get to all four of these video clips. This is by no means the entire contents, I have to stress here, but they're a good taster. Let's get to number four.
She pretty much is through with me. I got the strength. The big one helped me up, and I put my clothes back on voluntarily. And for some reason, I wasn't afraid no more. Huh? I was mad. And I throwed her against the wall when she come back the second time. And I was beating her head against the wall. And the big ugly one. And I called him out because I couldn't make it out. Gave me some kind of something. I could hear the psh again. Mm-hmm. And I just went limp. And the next thing I knowed, I was standing outside by the river.
And that's how it all ended. They obviously prepared him. They got him to put his clothes back on. They slipped him something that made him feel calmer about it seems. And that was it. It's pretty compelling. You know that there will be people who say, that's just random stuff stored away in the brain. That is no indication of anything. But of course, as you would say, Philip, and I think you'd be right, with all the circumstantial evidence, those photographs that you talked about and all the other stuff that's in this book, that makes a much more compelling case.
It does. And I asked Calvin what he felt about hypnosis, and to be honest, he wasn't that bothered about it. He says, I can remember everything anyway, you know. He said it clarified one or two points. What is interesting, about this recent video, right at the beginning, we haven't shown it here tonight because it doesn't mean a lot, but I said to the hypnotherapist, one of the few questions I put to her, just before anything kicks off, they're standing on this little broken down pier with their rods in the water, they're fishing. What does Calvin see? Just ask him to tell me what he sees around him. So he says, as he said before, he says, there's a boat going out to sea. I don't know how these big metal boats float. There's the bridge over there. And a little throwaway comment, Howard. He said, oh, there's two figures on the other side of the river. And I asked that question, and I don't know the answer. Are those two figures the other witnesses, Mr. and Mrs. Blair, who were watching back at what was going on with him and Charlie?
And who we knew nothing about until 2018.
Exactly.
Okay, we'll hear about that in the next segment. We've got some commercials coming up now. We're going to bring in Irina McCammon-Scott in the next segment, the co-author with Philip Mantle. And we'll also talk briefly with Philip first, before we talk to Irina, about the Charles Hickson stash of material that was gifted to Philip very recently and includes some amazing stuff, documents and all kinds of things, and a 45 RPM single record of Charles Hickson talking about all of this. It's fascinating. 50th anniversary of the Pascagoula incident. Calvin Parker, Charlie Hickson abducted by aliens, they say. Lots of evidence coming out and more witnesses appearing. We'll be hearing very soon from Maria Blair, who only appeared in 2018. We'll tell the story of that with Irina McCammon-Scott, Philip Mantle's co-author on their new book, Pascagoula, Beyond Reasonable Doubt. Just before we get to Irina, though, Philip, I want to ask you about the stash of material that you were gifted from Charles Hickson. Was this from Charles Hickson's estate?
You could call it that. It came from us by a lady by the name of Chelsea Norton Prince, who runs the Ocean Springs Historical Society. And it was one of their members, a lady by the name of Bethany Fayard, who said, I've got these two boxes of material. Bethany's mum and dad actually bought Charlie Hickson's house when he passed away. And everything was left in it. And they had these boxes of papers. They had more than they've given to us, but I think some were given away earlier. So they had two plastic bins, and she didn't know what to do with them. She thought, I'll donate them to the Historical Society. Just as Chelsea had an interest in the Pascagoula case and knew of me, she'd even met Calvin at one point, and she contacted me and said, would you like copies? And I said, yes, please, you know. And she said, well, I've got some kind of equipment that'll scan things in pretty quickly. Do you want everything? I said, whatever's in envelopes, the lot, just scan it, you know. And a lot of it is, you know, just people writing to Charlie trying to buy a book or whatever. But there's lovely little snippets of history in it as well, Howard. What sprang out of all this material, and I haven't gone through it all yet, but what came out first was there is a handwritten list. It's bullet points, 1 to 20, written by Charlie Hickson, describing the creatures bit by bit, how long he thought the point out their nose was, what their chest, you know, was 44 inches. One bulletproof at a time. One bullet point, I should say. Now, when you listen to Charlie and Calvin, when this thing initially landed, and they had two lights on it, and this opening appeared. Now, the whole thing baffled them, but being engineers, this opening puzzled them even more, because it appeared if it was there, and then it wasn't, you know. So Charlie seems to have tried to make a few drawings of this opening, and then there is a full-on sketch of the UFO, never seen before anywhere. I mean, there's letters to him from well-known people like Betty Hill. Betty's reporting some other sightings she had. Some well-known UFO researchers or UFO groups reporting things to him, as well as members of the public saying, Charlie, you know, in 19 whatever, this happened to me. But it's a lovely snapshot of history, and we're very grateful to Chelsea for sending this. Like I said,
wonderful.
It's amazing. I've gone through about 400 items so far. I think there's another 1,100 to go.
Gee. Well, so, you'll be kept busy for the next year or two. There was also, astonishingly enough, and I'm not sure how this thing got made, but a 45 RPM record, a single as we used to call them, if you remember those, a single record, which is Charles Hixon talking about what happened. And we've got a clip, and thank you for it. We've got a clip of that. Let's just hear it.
The craft hovered about 2 foot from the ground, and almost instantly an opening appeared at one end. And there's no way for me to express the feelings I had when these three things appeared in that opening. My God, Calvin, what's happened? I'll never forget those words. As I glanced toward Calvin, he seemed to be going in shock. He's 2 inches tall. The head seemed to come directly to the shoulders without a neck. The nose was about 1.5 inches long, and it came to a point. The ears were similar to the nose, maybe a little longer. And directly under the nose was a slit. It resembled a mouth. There could have been eyes. I can't recall what they looked like. Their skin, or it could have been some type of clothing, reminds me of elephant skin, and it was very wrinkled, and it seemed to shine. The arms resembled human arms, but the hands were webbed with something like a thumb, more like pincers, and the arms were long in proportion to the body. The legs remained together. And the feet seemed to be round, like an elephant's foot. And these things seemed to glide about the same height from the ground as the craft, and almost instantly were upon us. Two of them took hold of my arms from the side.
Amazing to hear Charles Hixon there, and thank you very much for giving me that sound. And I love the Johnny Cash reverb on it. It's very, very good. An amazing find. Hey, listen, we've kept her waiting. Irina McCammon-Scott, your co-author here, is also waiting. So, Philip, if you can hold on there while I talk to Irina. Irina, thank you so much for coming on. Good to see your face. How are you?
Okay, great.
Maria, you have contributed so much to this book, but the thing that grabbed me, and I've done an interview with this person myself, as you have done, was the conversation that you had with Maria Blair. Now, what nobody knew until 2018 was that it is claimed Hixon and Parker were not the only two people to have seen this, or indeed to have been abducted on that night, right?
Right. When I first started talking to her, it was just cold. Calvin had been on the YouTube, and one of their daughters had written and said their parents had been on the other side of the river and had seen something, but at that time they didn't know what it was, and later they did. But Phillips gave me the phone number of the mother, and I called her, and she said that what they had observed was is that they were sitting on, well, the husband was going to go out on a ship working, and they were sitting in the dock because the ship was going to come in. It was late, or the person that the captain or whoever, his supervisor, I think, was late. And so they were sitting there waiting, and the man went to sleep. Well, the wife said she saw this, what she considered to be an airplane, and it was just flying around, but it didn't go anyplace. It just go here and go there. And she kept saying, well, the pilot was lost. I mean, the pilot didn't know where he was going. He was confused. And then she said that her husband said, we'll walk on down the pier and go to the boat. And so they walked down the pier, and her husband was ahead of her. And she said that as they were walking down, that this thing that looked like a man flopped up on the pier right in front of her, right beside her, and then flopped down the water and never came up again. And she was very, very emotional about that. But then she said it was about 9 o'clock and they went on down to the boat. And then she said later she came back to the car. She said it was 12 o'clock and I wondered what on earth they were doing in the boat for that long. And she said she was really, really, really scared. and she ran all the way back to the car. Well, I interviewed her several more times, and I was trying to find out why she was so emotional about this thing that flopped out in front of her. And boy, I mean, she was really scared and really emotional, but she didn't seem to have any idea why. And her husband is sort of skeptical, and I talked to him briefly, and he thought, you know, he was saying nothing happened, you know, this was, you know, nothing. Maybe it was a porpoise or something, and maybe a blimp was flying around or something. And then, unfortunately, he became very sick, and very unfortunately, he died. But before he died, he said he wanted to get something off his chest, and he told her that they had been abducted, and that he apparently knew about it. I mean, he didn't want to say anything because he was a working person. He didn't want to get fired, and, you know, he needed his job and everything. And so he hadn't talked about it before. But he said he remembered the beings, and he apparently had been in contact with them before that, but he had never told her anything about it. So he described an abduction where he was on board, and it apparently was about the same. It was apparently, they thought it was after the Calvin and Charlie abduction, but they weren't sure. And then that he called one of them the doctor, and she thought that he didn't like this man, this whatever the thing was, and that maybe he'd done something physical to him or something.
No, exactly. And I had a chance to speak with Maria on Friday. She doesn't use internet, so we did it by telephone. But it was a fascinating conversation because, tell me if I'm right, the detail from Maria's side, Jerry apparently knew much more than Maria could recall about all of this. And he, of course, wanted to unburden himself before his sad departure, which he did. And then Maria was put under hypnotic regression herself, and more came out about that, about it all? Yeah?
Yeah, it was pretty spooky. One thing about it was, I don't think if she didn't remember very well of being on board. She said she opened her eyes a little bit when she was outside. But she said, they asked her why the things were here, and she said, well, they wanted eggs, and they wanted her eggs.
Okay, well, that is a very good point to get into. Just a little clip from the conversation that I had with Maria. I did half an hour with Maria. I will put it on my podcast within the next week. But this is just 2 minutes of the conversation I had on Friday with Maria Blair.
I just didn't want them being around me. I didn't want them touching me. I just wanted them to go on, leave me alone, but that didn't happen. I still feel scared about it because it was something that happened so suddenly, and I didn't know what they were. My husband did, but I didn't. And I was only like 23 years old at the time, so the world was still new to me out there, and seeing something like that was really shocking. And if I could have had it happen again, no, I wouldn't.
If they were harvesting DNA material from human beings, and from you in particular, I'm sure you have, but have you ever over the years given thought to the fact that there might be some hybrid human stroke alien person walking around that has elements of you in it?
Definitely. And I'm pretty sure there probably is. I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that they did get some of my eggs, and I'm pretty sure that things happened that I don't know. There's something in my mind that I know. Something happened or something went on that I can't just put my finger on and place it. It's just there, but I just can't know what it is. It's like being kept from me. And I always thought that my husband knew exactly what happened to me, but I still say he kept things from me from all them years. Because he knew, because he was alert. He was alert to what was going on. I wasn't. They kept me under, and he was, I still say he still knows something that when he died, he didn't tell me. I still think that.
Would you want to go through hypnotic regression again, Maria?
I would do that again, just to find out maybe a little more about what.
Having spoken and having found out a bit more about it, do you feel better than you did before?
I feel better about it that I've come forth and talked about it to people, because there's a lot of things I kept within me, you know, but there's still a lot of things out there that happened to me that night that I don't know what it was. I know it is, but I don't know what it was. And of course, my husband died with that in his mind, that he kept it to himself. And I know he knows, he knew more, but he just didn't talk about it.
Irina, thank you very much for talking with me, along with Philip. I think this material is remarkable, and it's amazing that that only came out 5 years ago. That is the encounter, they say, of Maria Blair and her late husband, Jerry. I just think it's very moving, actually, to hear Maria talk like that, because I can tell, and maybe you sense this too, Irina, that she's very sad that Jerry didn't tell her more, you know, during his life about this, because I think she senses that Jerry knew more than even he said at the end of his life. Do you agree?
Well, he couldn't talk. He was on a ventilator.
Sure.
And after he just told her that much, and then she had to guess what else he was saying, because he was dying, unfortunately, and on a ventilator, and he couldn't talk.
I think when he first started talking about it to Howard, she wasn't sad. She was raving mad, and it didn't matter how ill he was. I think he got it both barrels from her, you know.
She's a very feisty person.
Absolutely.
But all 30 minutes of that conversation will be on my podcast. We are out of time, unfortunately. Philip, I wish you all the very best, and Irina, with your book. It's called Pascagoula Beyond Reasonable Doubt. It is out for the 50th anniversary of this event. I thank both of you very much indeed, and of course the book is published by Flying Disc Press. And my thanks as ever to Philip Mantle and Irina McCammon-Scott for being involved in my show and for giving me that material first. I'm very, very grateful for what they did for me there. Now, as promised, exclusively to this podcast, it wasn't broadcast on the television. This is the full conversation with Maria Blair. I think there's 28 minutes or so of it. You make your own mind up about it. This is Maria Blair. Can you tell me, first of all, Maria, and thank you for doing this, how you and your late husband, Jerry, came to be in that place on the 11th of October, 1973?
Yes, sir, I'd be glad to. My husband was going out to work on a crew boat, and where the boat was docked at is where we went to for him to catch the boat. And the boat was, like I say, the boat was already at the dock. No phones to call people. We didn't have cell phones. We had to sit and wait in the car for the captain to get there. So that's what we did. We sat in the car, and it was getting, the sun was fixing to go down, and it was getting darker, and that's why we were sitting in the car, and we just sat there waiting, and of course, me sitting in the car, I was watching everything that was going on, and that's how we got to be there. He was going to work.
And what did you both see?
When I was sitting in the car, I could see the spacecraft as it came in view from Gaucher, and it came down like it was following the map of the Highway 90. It crossed over Highway 90 and descended down like an airplane. And I seen it when it was coming up behind Calvin and Charlie. I mean, I had a good view of everything because they were on the other side of the river, and they were on the west bank, and we were on the east bank looking in their direction.
But of course, you didn't know at that time that Calvin and Charlie were there, and you didn't know what this was at the time.
No, I didn't. I could just see what the things going on, and then, you know, later on, I kind of like figured it out that that's what happened. But as it came closer to us, I could see the lights flashing on the UFO. But anyway, after it had, I seen it when it got Calvin, and I seen it when it got Charlie, and it took them into the spacecraft, and I seen it when it brought them out. Well, as it brought them out, the spaceship shot straight up, and it flew down like it was following the map of the Pascagoula River. It came back. It went back like it was lost. And it went back and forth. And then finally, I told my husband, because he was over there trying to get some sleep, because he was going to be up all night. And I said, that airplane must be lost. He says, "Oh, that's not an airplane." Finally, he got sort of looking at it himself, and he said, "Oh, that's a helicopter." And I said, "No." So as we sat there watching it go back and forth, for some reason, he said, "Let's go put my clothes on the boat." And thinking about back at it right now, I kind of think, well, maybe they told us to get out of the car. That way they could, you know, better capture us. That's what I'm thinking now, but looking back on things. So we got out of the car, and we walked down to the pier. Now, it was already dark by then. It was real dark. It was getting close to around 7, 7:30, 8 o'clock. I mean, it was getting, you know, dark. And so as we were walking down the pier, something flew across real fast and landed in the water, and we heard a loud splash. And I turned around to my husband, and I said, "What was that?" He said, "Oh, that ain't nothing. Come on, let's go." So I said, "No, I want to see what that was." So I'm looking down in the water. As I'm looking down, I can see something down there. And I told him, I said, "There's somebody down there. I can see them." And about that time is when they floated up. And when it come over the side of the pier, I could see or knew that it was fixing to grab me. And that's when I screamed. And I don't recall anything else after that, after it touched me and grabbed me and I screamed. And
can you describe what it was? What came for you? What did it look like?
It was the humanoids. They were coming up the side of the, they were down, they were coming up for us. My husband had three over by him, and I had that one that come up and got me. And my husband was putting up a fight with the ones over there. And the one over by me, I mean, after he touched me, something happened to me where I just passed out. I have no recollection of what happened.
You must have been terrified.
And I was. I screamed, and I just remember it coming up at me. And after it touched me, I passed out. I don't know what happened to me after that. I don't know what happened. But my husband, he was over there. He told them not to hurt me, but this is what he told me. I didn't hear it because I was out. But this is like 50 years later. He kept secrets from me that he never told me what happened. He told me that he told them to not to hurt me. They floated us across. But this is what my husband's telling me now because I don't recollect none of this because I was out. But I do remember little bits and pieces of things where I would come to for a few minutes, and I remember as I'm floating over towards the spacecraft, I remember opening my eye a little bit and looking, peeking through my eye, and then I went back out, but I could have a sense that somebody or something was there beside me. But after that, after I shut my eye, I don't remember anything else after that. And
What did they look like, Maria? What did they, you know, how did they appear?
What I remember, because I was out most of the time, they had skin like an elephant, or they had like leathery skin. And like I said, I don't recall everything that happened that night, but because I was out most of the time, I was out. And I just remember going into the, for a few minutes, going into the spacecraft. And well, I remember when I come to, I was back where I was at on the pier. And I remember going, looking off to my right, and I remember seeing one of them floating back across the river. But other than that, I don't recall too much. Now, years later, my husband, after 50 years, come forth, because he never talked about it. He never told me anything about what happened that night, and I never talked to him about it. But after 50 years later, when he was on his deathbed, he told me when we were down when they were putting the marker up down in Pascagoula for Calvin and Charlie, we were leaving, and he said, "If they only knew what I know." And I got to thinking about, what does he know that he's not telling me? So when he was on his deathbed, I asked him, I said, Jerry, you know, there wasn't but two people on that pier that night, and that was you and me. I said, you better start talking. So during that particular time, he had a trait in his throat. And this is right before he passed away. And so I had to read his lips. And he said that they had taken us to the spaceship. And I said, a boat? He said, no, a spaceship. Well, he said ship. And then I said, what was it, a boat? He said, no, a spaceship. Me reading his lips. And then I said, what did they do to us? He said, they examined us. Now, this is coming from my husband. This is right before he passed away. But he waited 50 years before he told me because he never talked about it. And there was things that I did not know.
And in all of those years, Maria, did you have, I mean, something happened to you there and you both went home afterwards. So you must have said something between yourselves on the way home, for example. And even if you never talked about it again, you must have said, gee, that was a weird night, or what happened there?
No, he, when we was at the boat, when he caught the boat that night, he got on the boat and went out on the boat.
Right.
I left and went home. Yes, that's
and
what happened that night.
And you never spoke about it again?
Never. He never spoke about it. In fact, when he was in the hospital, I did a filming clip of him when he had his a pacemaker put in, his heart problems with, you know, coming on him, and they was fixing to put the pacemaker in him the next day. I got the phone out, and I said, now start talking, telling me something. I sent this little clip to Philip, and he says, I lied about what happened between me and my wife that night. He said, I did see that, he said, humanoids. Said, I did see what my wife seen. And he said, the humanoids. And then he said, he just talked about what had happened that night. He's mentioned all of it. He didn't talk too much about it. Even then, he didn't say much about it. He just kept everything to his. But he did see, he did admit that he did see the humanoids and that he did see what I seen. And
so this
that was
must
about
have,
it.
That must have bugged you for decades, the feeling that I know something happened, I just can't quite work out what it is, and I've only got a few little details in my head. So what happened,
yes,
wasn't it that your daughter, I think, saw a TV report about this, I think in 2018, and that's how you got in touch with Philip Mantle, and he arranged for you to be hypnotically regressed, is that right?
Yes, that was years later that we did that at Calvin's house, but yes, my youngest daughter, Tracy, she seen a clipping on Channel 10 News about the incident in Pascagoula, and she called the station and she told them that my mom and dad was there that night. And then Calvin and Irina Scott called us, and which was a surprise. We didn't know anything about any of this. So we called us and wanted to know what happened that night. And, of course, my husband wasn't going to talk about it even then. He hands the phone over to me. Of course, there was a lot of things that he hadn't told me that I couldn't talk about because he kept it from me for 50 years. You know, so I could only tell so much because I didn't know it, because he was keeping, like I said, 50 years he kept it from me of what happened on that pier that night. So
you had hypnosis, didn't you? And that took you back to the incident. And I think you learned an awful lot more about it, because effectively, I think they were certainly probing you, but experimenting on you, weren't they?
Yes, they were. They like to mess with your DNA. They experimented on me, and then I don't know what they did to him. He never did talk about that. He never said anything. And like I said, my husband was very, very careful about what he said about that night, because he was scared people would think what they would think of him, or think he was crazy. So he never talked about it. And it was back in them days, people didn't talk about it because they, you know, would think you were crazy. So he never talked about it, even to me.
What do you recall that they did to you? What sorts of experiments? Because I know that, as you said, they appeared to be interested in DNA. They appeared to be interested in us.
They our DNA and my eggs. They wanted some of my eggs, and so. Just anything to do with DNA and stuff like that. They probed. I mean, there's a lot of, and like I said, I was like in and out, so I don't recall everything. Because most of the time when I was with, was on the spaceship, they kept me out until I got back to the pier. And I remember when he set me back where I was, well, stood me back where I was on the pier. And then after we, me and my husband both, I turned around and looked, and that's when I seen one of the aliens floating back across the river. Of course, he seen all the other three floating back across the river, and he said, I kept my eye on that one, and he pointed to his right eye, and it must have been one of them that really gave him a hard time, because he kept, he said, I didn't keep my eye for him till he got out of my sight. And they floated on the back across the river, and he said, then I just seen the spaceship go straight up. It just shot straight up.
And when you were on board this craft, and they were, you think, harvesting your eggs perhaps, what were they telling you? What were they like with you?
They never, like I said, I was out the whole time. They never said, they never pathologically or whatever, said anything to me. I don't recall anything, just that they, I was out. They had me completely out. I don't recall anything.
And did they tell you why they were interested in us? Because the account again says the thought is that they wanted to, you know, they're here, those aliens, whatever they are, they're here, but they're disguised as us. And in order for them to be disguised as us, they need to look like us, and that's why they need to harvest stuff from us. Were you told that, or is that something that came out later?
I wasn't told that. I don't recall that, but I do know, I do know that they are here among us. They are, and they still pathologically talk to me. And I have seen them since then.
Have you?
Yes, I have.
About a couple of years when you ago. See them, what do they look like? You know, when they appear, do they just appear in your bedroom, or do they, you know, go down to Walmart with you? What do they do?
In the Walmart. That'd be good. Get shopping with them.
Well, no, we'd all like to see that.
Yeah. Well, I've seen them at several different times. Most of the time when I've, when I've seen them, the time that me and my granddaughter seen them, she was with me that night. And like Theodore, it's like a little place where they, you see a lot of them at night up in the sky, the UFOs, you see them, you can see them in the sky. And she said, Mama, she said, I want to see what a UFO looks like. And I said, okay. So I got to thinking, pathological, what I wanted. I wanted them to come and appear down where she could see them. So I'm driving down one street. I want to go down the other street. Going, this is at night now. It's after dark. It's probably about 8 or 8:30. And of course, if they want you to see them, you will see them. If you don't, you won't. They will not let you see them. And we're traveling down right where the high school is, Theodore High School, and we're driving along, and there's a church over here. It was on a Wednesday night, and the church was letting out. All the people are congregated outside the church. And as I'm going down, driving down the street, there's a CPAC over here, a little convenience store over on the right, and there's a three-way stop. And we're starting down that street, and right at the end of that street, right above the three-way stop, there was the UFO just sitting there. And I told her, I said, pulled on up, and they came up to the front of my car. That's when I had my Kia. They come up and hovered over the front of the car for her to see it. And all the people at that church did not see nothing. It was just me and her. We was the only ones allowed to see it, because I had asked them, you know, that she wanted to see them, so they did. They came up to the car. And I told her, I said, do you see it, Jamie Lynn? She said, yes. But she won't tell people that she's seen it, because she don't want people to think she's crazy. But she says, I did see it.
Okay. And then so can I just, I'm sorry to jump in. I just want to make it, you know, clear for people hearing this. You think that from when that happened in 1973, you had an ongoing relationship, connection with them, and they kept appearing. Is that so?
Yes, I do have a relationship with them.
But did it when you were not talking with Jerry about it for all of those years, were you aware of them, or have they only made themselves known to you since you started talking about it recently?
They've always pathologically talked to me, And I kind of think they did to him, too, but he just never said anything about it. Because, you know, he was mostly out on the boat, so I didn't see him much.
And do you think this was happening before that abduction experience?
I don't recall anything happened before then, no.
So they were clearly interested in you, weren't they?
Yeah. My husband told me it was me that they wanted. Mm. He definitely told me that.
When was the last time you saw them?
Oh, let me think. The last time I saw them was, well, I've seen them in Pascagoula since then, right in front of the Singing River Hospital. So I guess that was the last time in Pascagoula.
And we haven't really got to the explanation of what they look like. So can you just give me a description when you see them, even if nobody else can see them? What do they look like?
They look like just like with you see pictures of the aliens with the little, with the head, their back of their head's real big in the back of the head. I mean, that's what all I've seen of them.
Why are you talking about this now? Because it's obviously a traumatic thing. I can understand that.
I never actually talked about it too much either. And I don't talk about it unless somebody asks me anything. And I don't talk much about it. No, they really don't want you talking about them.
Really? Have they told you
that? I do. Yes. Yeah, they tell me not to.
Boy, and here you are. Here you are. You've gone and done it now.
Okay. Yeah, I got to tell it now, yeah. But seriously, they don't. They don't want you talking about them. And kind of like a little thing with me and them, I don't talk much about them, but we have like a little relationship between each other.
What would you say to people who are skeptical about your story, who say this sounds like fantasy?
Well, I really don't care what they think, because I know what I know, and I know what I've seen, and I know that the night on the pier when that happened, that was the most frightening thing. And I thought I knew everything about the world until they popped up on that pier, and I seen them, and it scared the heck out of me. And I said, "What is going on?" I didn't know what to think, because it happened so suddenly, and I would never want anything like that to happen to me again. I thought I knew the world, but undoubtedly I didn't.
You say they experimented on you, and they were maybe harvesting eggs, which is a story that we've heard from many, many people over the years, all the way back from Betty and Barney Hill and all the way through.
Yeah.
Did you, even though you didn't consciously immediately after recall what had happened, did you feel uneasy about anything? Were there any signs of anything having been done to you that you can look back on and remember now?
No, they never did anything to hurt me. Mm. They didn't hurt me, but it did leave a scar on my mind about everything, you know. I didn't want him touching me. I mean, from the beginning, whenever he come up and grabbed me on the pier, I've seen him, but I didn't want to see him, you know. I didn't want him touching me or anything. I just get away from me. But that didn't happen.
It's a long time since it happened. You know, I can remember 1973. It's 50 years this year. What are your thoughts and feelings now, Maria, then, now that we're coming up, it's in October, to the 50th anniversary of this thing? What does it make you feel?
Well, it's been a long time. It makes me feel, I don't feel like that I was, that they should have, I don't know. I just didn't want them being around me. I didn't want them touching me. I just want them to go on, leave me alone, but that didn't happen. And I still feel scared about it, because it was something that happened so suddenly, and I didn't know what they were. My husband did, but I didn't. And I was only like 23 years old at the time, so the world was still new to me out there, and seeing something like that was really shocking. And if it could have had it happen again, no, I wouldn't.
If they were harvesting DNA material from human beings, and from you in particular, I'm sure you have, but have you ever over the years given thought to the fact that there might be some hybrid human stroke alien person walking around that has elements of you in it?
Definitely. And I'm pretty sure they're probably, yes, I don't know, but I'm pretty sure that they did get some of my eggs, and I'm pretty sure that things happen that I don't know. There's something in my mind that I know. Something happened or something went on that I can't just put my finger on it and place it. I just it's just there, but I just can't know what it is. It's like being kept from me. And I always thought that my husband knew exactly what happened to me, but I still say he kept things from me from all them years. Because he knew, because he was alert. He was alert to what was going on. I wasn't. They kept me under, and he was, I still say he still knows something that when he died, he didn't tell me. I still think that.
Would you want to go through hypnotic regression again, Maria?
Sure, I would. I would do that again, just to find out maybe a little more about what occurred to me, because I know there's things or other things that happened to me that my husband was so, I don't know why he wanted to keep everything so secret from me, but he was so scared to talk about it because he thought about what other people would think of him or think that he was crazy. So he just never did even talk about it, you know, even to me.
I'm glad you spoke with me. Having spoken and having found out a bit more about it, do you feel better than you did before?
I feel better about it that I've come forth and talked about it to people, because there's a lot of things I kept within me, you know, but there's still a lot of things out there that happened to me that night that I don't know what it was. I know it is, but I don't know what it was. And of course, my husband died with that in his mind, that he kept it to himself. And I know he knew more, but he just didn't talk about it.
So it's unfinished business, isn't it, in a way?
Yeah. It was like that night that was like when we went down to, when they put the marker down in Pascagoula, me and him went down there. When he got in the car, the first thing he said to me, if they only knew what I know. And I'm thinking, well, what does he know? And I never asked him, and then I'm thinking later after he passed away, I should have asked him what more did he know? Because he knew so much when he died that he never talked about nothing. But he did come forth when I got onto him in the hospital and told him there was nobody else on that pier that night, Jerry, but you and me, so you better start saying something. Of course, he couldn't talk. I had to read his lips, and then he started telling me that they took us to the spaceship. Well, he said to the ship, and I didn't know what he meant by ship. I said, a boat? He said, no, a spaceship.
And I know you say you were unconscious for your experience for most of it.
Yes.
So do you have any recollections of the ship?
Yeah, I remember when we were coming up right close to the, I was floating, and I guess it was the one of the humanoids beside me. I could sense him there. And I just remember cracking my right eye open just a little bit, and I was peeking through. Of course, you couldn't open your eyes very wide because the light coming through the door of the spaceship was very bright. And I just remember cracking my eye open just a little bit, but it was the ship was metallic, and it was oval-shaped, but it was metallic. And we're coming up towards the door, and I guess he just put me back under again when I got right close to the door. But I just remember cracking my eye open and looking, and I went right back out. I don't remember anything after that. As soon as I got to the door of the ship, that was it that I remember seeing. Most of the time, I was out.
Do people know you in Pascagoula now, Maria? Are you a bit of a celebrity there?
Well, there's a few people do, but most of the... I'm not a celebrity there. No, I'm not a celebrity there. But they know your story. Oh, yeah, they know the story. Yeah, they know the story of... But most people just think it was Calvin and Charlie that got abducted, but it was more to the story that wasn't told, because everything happened so fast back in that day in 73 when the news people come in there and started grabbing things and news reporters out there. Of course, my husband went on off on the boat. I went home, so it was never spoken about. It was never brought to anybody's attention that me and my husband was abducted too, because he kept it to himself all these years.
And I know that 50th anniversary is probably going to be quite busy for you when it comes in October.
Yes, sir.
But thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you.
And as I said, Maria Blair doesn't do many interviews, if any. That is one of them. It was recorded last Friday as I record these words. So your thoughts about that, of course, as ever. Welcome. Before that, Irina McCammon Scott and Philip Mantle behind the brand new book, which I think is the best one ever written about Pascagoula, Pascagoula Beyond Reasonable Doubt. More great guests in the pipeline here at the Home of the Unexplained. So until we meet again, my name is Howard Hughes. This has been The Unexplained Online. And please, whatever you do, stay safe, stay calm, and above all, please stay in touch. Thank you very much. Take care. Bye-bye.